This program is brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. We hope you enjoy the program. Hello, and welcome to the latest mini-episode of the Anchoring Truths podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Snedeker. For our first mini-episode 2 weeks ago, we didn't give an overview of what we were doing with this new installment, and so we hope to do so today. Mini-episodes are shorter than our normal podcast episodes, about 30 minutes compared to somewhere between 45 and 60 minutes. Sometimes we'll have on guests, just like in our longer episodes. Sometimes, though, we'll feature internal discussions among JWI staff about what might be next on the horizon for the conservative legal movement, or perhaps what might be some arguments animating law, culture, or politics. But more than anything else, with these mini-episodes, we're laying the groundwork for even more discussions that we think our listeners will enjoy, more regular discussions. And so we hope you enjoy this new installment. Our guest on today's episode is Nate Fisher. Nate is the chairman and founder of New Founding. Nate has broad investment and company building experience with a particular focus on macro changes and risks. He's made control or lead investments in manufacturing, career prep, and alternative investment companies. He previously co-founded InvestRes, a billion-dollar real estate company, and has helped launch several civic organizations. He's a Claremont Institute Lincoln Fellow. He lives with his wife and four children in Dallas, Texas. However, we have Nate on today's episode to talk about one of the more provocative pieces that I've read in quite some time. It was an essay at Claremont's American Mind online journal called "Meritocracy Must Not Be Our Goal." I found this piece to be fascinating because of how somebody like Nate, who clearly is accomplished, has had many personal successes in business, Nate rejects so many of the standard arguments that are made in favor of meritocracy, but he does so from an angle that you might not expect. So we hope you enjoy today's episode. Nate Fisher, we are delighted to have you on our Anchoring Truths podcast. Nate, what's your beef with merit and what's your beef with meritocracy?
So glad to be here, Garrett. Thanks for having me. I'll start by saying I have no beef with merit in many ways. I think merit's a good thing. My concern is holding that up as the ideal, as in a sense the North Star that we aim for to organize a society. Meritocracy is rule by those with merit, and as merit is conventionally understood, that's typically framed in terms of technocratic measures, test scores, people who perform well at certain skill measures. And ultimately, I think that's it's not just the wrong, it's not just a suboptimal ideal. It's one that is actually a lot closer to DEI than many people realize. It actually assumes many of the same premises that led to the DEI regime we have today.
So let me push back a little bit with a comparison I know you'll be familiar with because you're a lawyer and I think you'd consider yourself a natural lawyer. Why are the standards of meritocracy not just like the application of positive law that might be inspired by natural law? Certainly positive law can err, but the positive law done in its most excellent way harmonizes with natural law and distills it for real world circumstances.
Well, so I think that if I'm hearing that analogy right, I think that would be akin to prioritizing merit or capability or certain sets of skills in many particular decisions where that's an important factor. Look, I'm not saying you don't want it in any circumstances. I think it's a valuable thing. It's a good thing. I want my pilots to have certain capabilities. I want a heart surgeon to have certain capabilities. I think the challenge with the ideal is you're universalizing that principle. So just like with law, you're moving out of the prudential application of certain principles to something that is sort of dogmatically applied as an axiom to every circumstance. And that's where I think this is a good time to focus on the contrast. The contrast is that I propose is ownership as an ideal. Owners by nature, owners and others with skin in the game by nature, they will make decisions that accord with probably what you describe in situations where they recognize the importance of capabilities, but they also may not. They also may choose to pass their business on to their kid, even if there's theoretically more qualified person to run it. They may choose to hire people in their community for certain reasons, even if there's more qualified, even if there's people who have more merit by some standards, were you to outsource the factory to Asia. So or do it in a different state, or hire someone who's coming from out of town. There may be any number of factors that come into play. And what I focus on in my alternative is it's good to have a system where judgment comes down to owners who are in a position to exercise human judgment. And that human judgment, I would say, is analogous to, in many ways, the prudence of the lawgiver, except it's sort of, because it's more personal, they actually have, I would say, a broader range of judgments that are sort of well within their right. But the prudence of the lawgiver is very different than the application of universal principles that he must apply sort of across the board, no matter what.
Mm. Yeah, I think when I read your piece, that's where the light bulb went off for me, and why I thought it was such an insightful analysis, because what you were seeming to diagnose was this 20th century and into the 21st century drift from capital flowing to those entities that were managed well versus those entities that were owned and stewarded well. And this being a phenomenon that you couldn't do at scale until, call it what you will, like the post-war era and, growing multinational, companies that would then be able to derive value from like broad management of people and resources and processes. And that became for you the way to connect it with the rise of DEI. Can you explain to our listeners how you track that? Particularly, I think you mentioned that, the real rise of DEI began earlier than many people would think in the 1980s.
Well, so I think that I see DEI as just one manifestation of managerialism, of this underlying ideology, this underlying doctrine of technocratic managerialism. And that really is something that's closely associated with the progressive era, with the progressive movement very broadly. I mean, the progressive, I think in many ways, the essence of progressivism is this idea that you can engineer society, that you can, the social sciences came up where you decided that managing people became a science. And that has a certain view about people. It has a certain view about, and if it has a certain view about people, it also has a certain view about decision-making, where essentially management moves from something that really is about human prudence, human judgment. You could even say human entrepreneurial bets. There's when you take a risk on someone, there's a judgment that goes into it, recognizing fallibility of different parties, but recognizing sort of creative potential, to something where it becomes a much more objective, analytical process. And you believe that with the right incentives in place, with the right sort of models, with the right with people who have been trained to become themselves sort of skilled in very formulaic ways, that you can engineer any range of a result, and then sort of more optimistically for them, any result you want, in terms of certainly when you think of progressivism, you think of that typically in the political space, but that same doctrine was applied to the idea that you could engineer large organizations, and essentially you want to replace those executives, those owners who exercise prudent judgment, with experts with MBAs would be a great example of this, where you bring in the professionals and they make objectively correct decisions based on the science of management. And I think you saw that in many ways back to the late 19th century, and certainly in the business world, you saw it particularly in the early to mid 20th century, and really the post-war, early post-war era, as you had large corporations. And I don't even know if that's you talk about capital flowing to that. In many ways, it's sort of management taking over. It's the managerial class taking over capital. Uh-huh. And in some ways, that was as much a process of government imposition as it may have been of market forces driving capital there. But it was a parallel to many of the same trends that we saw over in the Soviet Union. So these were global trends, and there was this sort of global embrace of this idea that managerial bureaucracy was the way to run organizations at a large scale. And mm-hmm. going to sort of finish the loop to how this ties into DEI, how does DEI come out of this? Well, if you believe that you can engineer whatever outcome you want, then you no longer are focusing on, you're no longer focusing on the individual, for one thing. The decision of hiring is no longer about, let's say, you as an employer sort of making a bet on a particular person, building a relationship with a particular person. And it becomes much more about models. And if you have a model of the world, as an example, I mentioned the blank slate hypothesis, the idea that sort of presumptively we should, by default, in a society that is fair or whatever, we should have equal representation in sort of every role of people from every demographic category, then any disparity you see, especially, let's say, in higher paid or executive ranks, any demographic disparity can be presumed to be the product of either sort of adverse societal factors, let's call it systemic racism, or even sort of implicit biases, maybe explicit biases of some sort within the organization. So it makes perfect sense that applying that managerial mindset, you just add some additional correctives to the decision making. You either try to unbias the managers, maybe you try to keep things blind so they're not seeing the final decision makers, not seeing the person, and it's turned into a more inhuman process. By doing that, I mean, the seeds of DEI are really attempts to correct what they saw as errors of managers, errors of people who were operating because of their human biases as sort of less than purely scientific managers. But it's a perfect extension of that managerial mindset. In many ways, it's perfectly compatible with a narrative of meritocracy, because theoretically, the DEI is actually helping you find the person with the most merit, despite the biases built into the system. So they wouldn't even frame it as intention. And sort of given their recognition of, given their sort of theories about human biases, it becomes necessary to actually top down impose these correctives to engineer out the biases that humans left to their own devices will naturally apply to their decisions.
That's great. I want to, for the benefit of our listeners, read an excerpt from your piece that builds off what you just said and then kind of launches us into another discussion. So this is quoting from Nate's piece in The American Mind. In sum, DEI turns people into the individualized, deracinated, interchangeable cogs that fit best into managerial organizations. To satisfy the intrinsic religious drive most people have, it offers a program of rituals and ideals that, in a sense, baptize the managerial system. Given this dynamic, it's no surprise that the relatively meritocratic approach of the 1980s through 2000s gave way to the pervasive DEI regime of the past decade. Meritocracy is not a stable alternative. It is simply another expression of the managerial system that features the same underlying dynamics. So what is the real opposite of wokeism? It is an alternative, not just to DEI, but to managerialism itself, ownership. Now, in response to your piece, you told me that one insightful comment noted that merit, the meaning of the word merit implies a sense of duty or obligation based on either past performance or based on some kind of, you know, previous understanding of something that's owed to that person. And there's some internal tension with that understanding of merit than with the understanding of ownership, a much more human process that we, you know, can root back to. You know, if you're a law student, you learn in property that you know, ownership can be transferred as soon as you lose something. Somebody else can find it and then have ownership. There's no external, you know, processes that go into you know, analysis. It's much more rooted in what we would call common sense, and the common law reflects that. So I guess what I wanted to maybe, you know, get into was, what do you see as that much more human aspect to the alternative to managerialism in ownership?
Absolutely. Well, I'll start by touching on the point about the concern about meritocracy. And I think that at the very highest level, I guess merit by its nature includes this idea that something is deserved. You merit a role. If you're qualified for a role, then the person making the decision can hire you. It implies a lot of the same traits that we associate with meritocracy. To say you merit it by its very nature is going beyond that and saying you deserve that. So it's sort of a reversal of agency. It's a meritocracy is saying you're owed the role by virtue of certain traits that say you merit it. Now, you could, at the highest level, you could make it tautological, right? A meritocracy is ruled by those who are entitled to role, but that begs the question. Most people mean by that, in a sense, rule by those who have the most skill or capability, and they use a word that actually implies that those people deserve the role. So when you think about that, what is that doing? It's reversing the agency and it's stripping the agency from the decision maker, who could have every reason to choose between any number of qualified applicants, and it's saying you have to essentially treat them fairly, so to speak. And fairly would mean you have to reward the earliest one. Now, I think one example is that's direct contradiction to the parable that Jesus gave of the workers and their wages, where he paid the same wage to everyone regardless of when they start, and made the point that as the owner, is it not his right to he owes them what he agreed to pay them, but he has the right to do with his property what he wants beyond that. And as an owner, the system I'm emphasizing, as an owner, you have skin in the game. If you make bad decisions, if you make imprudent decisions, you will probably lose your ownership. You will lose the ability to continue making decisions like that. Within that scope of ownership, my view is you have discretion of what you do with your property. You don't owe a job, you don't owe an opportunity to the person who checks the most boxes on paper. You're imprudent probably to give it to someone who doesn't meet certain qualifications, but you're fully within your rights, as an example, to make an entrepreneurial bet on another person. An example I like to give is actually investing. I think is in many ways an even easier example. You can invest your money with the asset manager whose projects pencil out on paper the most. Sort of from an analytical perspective, you can with the most certainty arrive at the sort of checking all the boxes to show that they will earn you a good return. And the problem is that ends up being a process where it favors those things that can pencil out on paper. It favors the sort of certain over the uncertain. Ultimately, what it does is it favors the inhuman over the human. So it's hard to beat by a standard like that. You tend toward things like apartment buildings or government bonds, because ultimately, if you discount anything that can't be modeled reliably on the spreadsheet, you're going to you're going to arrive at the certain. And I think that managerial doctrine applied to investment very often takes us in that direction. It takes us in what ultimately becomes an investment strategy stripped of human judgment. And the contrast I would give is you take a bet. Let's say you take a bet on a young guy you know from church, or maybe he was recommended by someone who whose judgment you trust in another tight circle like that. And it's someone who doesn't check all the boxes on paper early in his career. And you bet on someone like that to, let's say, buy and flip a piece of property, which is really a job that requires a lot of hustle for a smaller piece of property. Ultimately, that's an entrepreneurial bet on a person. That is something where you could not possibly check all the boxes and come to as sort of safe of an investment there as you would buying a share of an apartment building with an experienced apartment owner. But if you're right, what do you get? If you're right about your bet on the person, you get someone who through his hustle, through his other virtues is able to produce an extraordinary return. You'll earn an outsized return. You'll also provide a path that gets someone an opportunity to build a career, often a career that doesn't highly correlate with the sort of traits to get an MBA and things. A lot of times that's sort of an alternative path by which people get started on will end up being multi-million dollar careers. So a society that has those sort of human bets, not only will I expect it produces outsized capital returns, a good successful bet on a person is capable of earning outsized returns for the investor. And it's capable of providing enormous opportunity for the recipient of that investment. And so you look at that, and I think you have the sort of natural trend of managerial finances toward greater and greater stagnation, toward sort of the stripping out of anything that falls out of that analytical framework. The alternative, the human direction, involves at its essence series of entrepreneurial bets by people as creative agents, by people who as owners are able to make a bet that they cannot fully back up on a spreadsheet as superior to any other bet, but they're applying a sort of holistic framework that an owner with skin in the game can do. And what you see is you see both higher returns coming out of that, and you see a much, much more dynamic environment where people can get that sort of opportunity. The recipients of that can get that sort of opportunity in ways that look very different than the path they might have to pursue if they want to sort of pursue the conventional credential ladder. It allows a different type of person to succeed to that point. It's in many ways, I would say, a more human economy where there's a multitude of paths and a multitude of allocators of opportunity are going to recognize different types of talent, different types of capability, and make those bets.
And so this then ties into your broader strategy at New Founding, at deciding where to invest. And for those of us who have been following New Founding closely, we have seen you invest in small businesses, but also invest in larger efforts, such as to change how work is being done, right? New Founding purchased an office building and wants to change the model of how that can be used with aligned entrepreneurs. And so where do you see the sort of cracks in the managerial system forming, and then how can finding talent in the way that you at New Founding have, how can finding talent and then cultivating that talent based on non-traditional meritocratic measurements perhaps show an alternative to more than just our merry band of misfits who are willing to invest outside of the traditional ETF and mutual fund strategy?
Well, that's sort of a number of facets of that, and I'll run through them. And at the very going to the point about the office, we ended up leasing a part of an office that was a nicer building than we could have bought to start proving out the concept. But what we're doing is we're creating an aligned office community. It's a community where a number of organizations and a number of individuals are working together. Elements of what you would see at a WeWork, right? You have the ability to get a shared, be in a shared office space. You can have flexible leases, have a desk. But what we are focusing on in addition to that is that layer of alignment, that layer that you really want when you go to work. You want, especially in a world of remote work, I think people realize this. If you're going to go to work, if you have the option of not going to work, if you're going to go to work, you really want to be able to work around people who share your values in important ways. In a world where the values in the corporate world become more fractured, where sort of dissident views are increasingly punished in the corporate world, there's a real reward to being around people who share those values. And it's not just a sort of personal reward. I think it extends to professional. You end up building trust in an environment where there's a much greater likelihood that you're going to build a connection that leads to actually doing business with someone. You have a bunch of people who are sort of motivated by these, you could say, intangible factors. They're certainly outside of the conventional business calculus that motivate them to want to do business with each other. And that's an environment that's rich in opportunity for someone who wants to find new business partners in various capabilities, because the default, sort of a default yes type of environment, if you can provide something of value. Now, what else are we doing that sort of fits this human model? I mean, the very essence, we have a venture fund. Early stage, we do pre-seed and seed stage investments. And it's sort of a rolling fund where there's continual opportunity to invest. And then we've invested in a few different companies in this space. And at the very essence of venture investment is a bet on a person. More than anything, an early stage venture investment is really an evaluation of the founders, an evaluation of how they think about an opportunity. But fundamentally, the question is, can these people execute? Are they the right people to execute in this opportunity? Do they have something to go above and beyond what the sort of formulaic outcome would be here? Because you don't create a great business by applying sort of formulaic in the box level execution. You're betting on founders who go beyond that. So you can think of that as sort of venture remains one of the essentially human components of investment, at the opposite end of the spectrum of sort of passive allocation to apartment complexes and ETFs. And then more broadly, and this is sort of this crosses everything that we are looking to do, how do we facilitate in more ways than this business within aligned communities? And the problem I'm exploring, and this goes beyond what we're doing currently, a problem I'm exploring is there's an element of creating the conditions for this. But I think a big opportunity, maybe the biggest opportunity of our day, is recognizing that as societal trust drops, as institutional trust drops, I mean, you're seeing trust in institutions like Harvard drop without question. I think there was already a sort of dislike of them among conservatives, but you look at the recent Claudine Gay scandal and such, and there's no question that that impairs many, many people's opinion of the value of a Harvard degree. People look at it and that the credential just doesn't signal the same thing. Trust in these institutions has dropped. And what is the alternative? The alternative, in a sense, the very foundations of the technocratic managerial system are losing trust. People are losing confidence in those. An alternative is the sort of human judgments of the sort I describe. And I think that where people will look for those sorts of human connections are very often existing high trust communities, perhaps the sort that used to actually be forums for commerce as well. But where that's often been crowded out over recent decades. So I look at church communities, and church communities remain these particularly high trust communities in many cases, where you can find people, even if the credential isn't necessarily the same, you might be able to trust a recommendation of a lawyer through a church community. And in a world where you're sort of trust in the in the trust in the credential itself, or trust in the law firm that's hires a bunch of these people, drops, you become more and more drawn to an alternative where you can get things like trusted recommendations, where you can find people who you have another way of underwriting, another way of assessing a bet on that person for any number, any wide range of trust-based decisions you make in your life. So at the essence of what we're exploring, of what we're interested in, is how do we systematically open opportunities for more commerce among aligned people, generally via sort of aligned high trust networks, in a world where you're seeing greater, at the societal level, you're seeing greater alienation, you're seeing a general drop in trust. And that's a fundamentally human, we're essentially relying on the human, relying on the entrepreneurial, at the very least out of necessity, because the sort of managerial credentials are just less suitable. They're less effective.
Mm-hmm. Last question before we have to depart. I've got my copy of our mutual friend James Poulos's Human Forever behind me, and I'm reminded of one of James's observations that the fight in the 21st century is not over whether or not there will be bots and algorithms running behind us all the time. It's who will catechize those bots, who will catechize those algorithms. Do you see the meritocracy as having similar bots and algorithms that are catechized already by DEI and them as a lost cause, and therefore ownership really is the only path? Or do you have perhaps the both end approach, where an emphasis on ownership will show that indeed the managerial approach does have these bots that have been catechized behind it, these assumptions that are assumed to not exist by many, but the ownership alternative will reveal them to be so and will look attractive by comparison?
That's a that's an excellent question, and I think it's perceptive to sense the parallels between the algorithms that already exist in a managerial system and the algorithms that will become pervasive in a digital system. I think it's a good question. My sense is you could theoretically achieve a reprogramming of the managerial algorithms, but I don't know that it's I don't know that that is a path that is, in a sense, that would be the people who emphasize managerialism or meritocracy as an ideal are trying to reprogram the managerial algorithms, or trying to reprogram them away from DEI toward meritocracy. I think that's possible to an extent. I think it could achieve something. But the point, I guess, I would emphasize is that still leaves a system that is very managerial in many ways. This can be a limit. That is certainly a better world. It's a world I would rather live in, a world where pilots are hired on the basis of conventional skill measures rather than DEI criteria. And I think that's sort of a valiant cause for people like Bill Ackman and people like that are going to be focused on that, who really don't share many aspects of our values, our worldview in many ways. At the same time, in a sense, my piece is aimed at the right. I published in The American Mind, which is sort of a discourse on the right for strategy. And I would say our efforts in a world where the institutional infrastructure, the DEI infrastructure, is as powerful as it is, we're fighting uphill. We're a dissident movement. We're a movement without a ton of institutional power. And we direct that power at trying to reprogram the current institutional algorithms. And that's a very, very tough effort. It's a fighting uphill in many ways. If we focus on changing the medium, as I'm talking about with ownership, in a sense, you rather than directly trying to reprogram those algorithms, you're trying to, going to sort of the Poulos analog, you're trying to change the focus on who the decision maker is, then you're doing something that's potentially more disruptive. And I think that it aligns with a lot of the disruptive trends we're seeing in technology. Technology is eroding and undermining the confidence in these institutional credentials and these institutional bases of trust, period. And people are intuitively going to look for, as a result, they're going to look to skin in the game more and more as a basis for credibility. I think that's an inevitable, digital trend. And so you're going to see a disruption of the current system to some extent. And I think that if you're a minority movement, if you're a dissident movement, then you have enormous opportunity if you're playing at that point of disruption. This is why I think it's so important for people on the right to be in the fray with disruptive technology, because what better opportunity than being at the point where something could reshuffle the deck if you're not positioned to, if you're going to be at a disadvantage in the conventional game. And so, again, I don't want to dismiss efforts that are trying to reprogram that managerial algorithm. I think there's value to that. But the high returns, the opportunity to really turn the tables and change the direction of our society on this will come. I think that will come by focusing on the digital. That's a very, very good one that James does. And I think in many cases, we will continue to be governed by algorithms rather than people. And the question then becomes who catechizes the algorithms. But I also think digital disruption will destroy many of the pretenses that have led to the imposition of algorithms in many areas of life that would actually be better made by people with skin in the game, by owners. And so I think that digital disruption itself will lead to a re-emphasis on skin in the game. And this focus on ownership that I emphasize here aligns with that. And I think has the potential to, I mean, you think of at a high level, if you sort of systematically change the legitimacy of managing a mid-sized business from the idea that it has to be done by a set of MBAs with the right credentials to it's good for the owner. Let's say it's in a mid-sized city in Missouri, right? It's good for the owner to be the one making the decisions. Those people are already in place. Those people are already generally heavily involved. They're already exercising authority and sort of shifting the public mindset from one where you should be suspicious of their decisions and we should add regulations on a regular basis to chip away, to a regime that recognizes that that's in many ways an ideal and we should be doubling down. We should, from a policy perspective, from every perspective, from a cultural perspective, there should be a status involved in running a business like that. That should be recognized as really a very highly human endeavor, that exercise of authority. All of those things can, I think, pretty rapidly change because in a sense that alternative elite, that ownership-based elite is already in place across the board. So anytime you bring Poulos and those ideas into it, it could be a sort of extended conversation. But I'll say, look at where the low hanging fruit is. Look at where trends are driving things that could be in our favor if we play them right.
Before we go, Nate, where can our listeners keep up with your writing and where's the best way for them to follow what you're doing at New Founding?
So I'm most active on Twitter. So you can find me at Nate A. Fisher on Twitter. You can also follow New Founding on Twitter. You can check out newfounding.com. And on newfounding.com, we talk about our different projects. We talk about the fund. We talk about some of the other stuff we're working on. And I'll certainly talk about my writing as I do it on Twitter. So tend to share it in a number of different publications, but you'll see everything there.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much. And we'll make sure to link to the piece, Meritocracy Must Not Be Our Goal, published in the American Mind in February, 2024 in the show notes. And course to Nate's Twitter and to New Founding. Thank you so much and talk to you soon.
Thanks, Garrett.
This program has been brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. Thanks for listening.